Greetings, comrades, and welcome to the Eastern Border. This is just a short intro between my next episode, which is going to be about Russian ethnic and demographic conditions in their country, which I was asked to do. But for now, I just wanted to post an extra. And this extra happens because, as I said in the last episode, Mike was answering a bunch of questions from the Russian opposition journalists. And one of these questions that I didn't manage to ask, which were just poked at me afterwards, was the fact that, quote, the people were just confused that the fact that to many people, the idea that some general might pocket some ammo was just not a valid or serious enough reason to not give Ukraine whatever it needed now. And also a question that like popped up just after people listened to this episode was the following, quote, why the hell West at this point don't lower standards for ammunition a bit? I mean, they will obviously not gonna be kept for 20 plus years in warehouses, nor do they need to be as stupidly accurate as Western doctrine demands. This could easily allow for more production and help for Ukraine, and they'd be cheaper individually too. Oh, and they will be less appealing to any market that's not Ukraine, thus lower the corruption incentive as well. So, what gives? That was the most important question that, I was asked. And, Mike being the awesome human being that he is a really good, great guy. I love him. He gave me a 17-minute answer to this. 17 minutes, yeah. Which is why I'm releasing it now in full. Just so while I'm making the demographics thing, you can listen to it because it answers a lot of those questions and puts a lot of effort into this. I just thought that it would be very important to let you know what the question was because he responds to the question in his own Discord for 17 minutes. But it works as well. Meanwhile, yeah, here to go. This is the interview extra. And what's coming up is my episode on why and how the demography and ethnical divisions in Russia work out. Enjoy.
Hey, mate. Thanks for having me on the other night. It's great to see the episode up. And yeah, I think had I probably had more than about half an hour's sleep, I probably would have been a bit sharper. But I thought it's a great question you sent through. So I think I'd elaborate on it a bit and take time to actually unpack it a bit more. Because I think we're kind of at that point racing through a whole bunch of different topics. The first one is corruption within the Ukrainian military. So it's not a massive concern at the moment. And we actually coincidentally went through this in this week's episode of The Red Line. Effectively, right now, the Ukrainian war is so ammunition thirsty that it's just drawing in any bit of black market arms from everywhere or else, whether that be the US going and searching for it or whether it be people buying on behalf of Ukraine or Ukraine going searching for it. Effectively, anything that matches any of the calibers will just be hoovered up. It's why your standard markets in Kosovo, Albania, Croatia have been hoovered up. And Bulgaria as well, actually, has had a whole bunch. So that's, the risk of sort of black market arms coming out of Ukraine at the moment is very minimal because they're using all the ammunition they have. That's the good thing. And if there were the widespread corruption that we see alleged towards Ukrainian generals, we would see things like American man pads effectively going up for sale. And we haven't seen any of that hitting black markets, not in any significant quantity. It may be enough that wouldn't be surprised to see one or two have escaped out, and I wouldn't be shocked to see Russia try and use that as a point closer to the election, have one appear in Palestine or whatever and kind of go, haha, see you. But again, I think it's very minimal, not something to worry about. The concern is what happens if the war, effectively hits a stalemate period or an end to the war. And again, I don't see an end to the war anytime soon. But if there's a return to effectively the status quo of 2014, where they're still at war, but the intensity of the fighting shrinks remarkably. In which case, they will have a lot of ammunition lying around, and that's when things can be possibly sold. Do I think that's likely? Probably not, but it is the concern that people will share. The second one about ammunition is a weirdness of procurement. And you can already probably, understand why I don't go down this road too often, because it's just such a really boring topic, I think. But what you sign off on effectively for procurement quite often doesn't arrive for 2 years. So a lot of the fights for Ukrainian arms and armaments and stuff will effectively be fighting for what will appear in a few years. And there are lots of things that effectively the US and other countries can do to get ammunition to Ukraine with, you know, circumventing even if the Republicans cause problems. So right now, for instance, when the before October 7th, there was a massive garrison or massive surplus of US caliber ammunition sitting in bunkers in Israel. And the US managed to effectively, you know, it sits in Israel. It is property of the US, but can be accessed by the Israelis upon, you know, a invasion of the country. The US effectively managed to pillage some stuff from that and give it to Ukraine in, I think it was 23 or 20, beginning of 24. No, it was beginning of 23. So that's one way you can do it. We're already starting to see some backroom deals going ahead, effectively that a bunch of gear that the US won't be allowed to give to Ukraine if the Republicans are, you know, arcing up, can be, let's say, sold to Greece, and then Greece can pass that off to Ukraine, because that would technically meet the rules. It could be done under the executive branch. So there's ways of getting around it. The where we're sort of bringing the two-year problem is that if you want to scale up to the level of ammunition production that would be required for a maintenance of this, you know, intensity level, or at the production level in which Ukraine would be required to go on the offensive. Because again, let's, you know, kind of break it down into, for anyone who doesn't get it, you know, if you have you know, random numbers here, but effectively you use 10 shells a day to go on the offensive, you know, 3 shells a day to kind of hold the status quo, and 1 shell a day if you're happy to give ground to the Russians. To go on that big offensive, you know, you effectively need to be stockpiling, in which case you need to know, you know, you don't want to burn those, you know, those 10, knowing that you might have those 3 to even maintain with the ground you have. So the worry here is always going to be that, you know, you need to have a massive supply chain coming down the line as well, in order to keep the chain going. So a lot of this fights for Ukrainian ammunition is effectively they are burning up through what they've got. Europe hasn't been able to scale up to nearly the levels they said they would. And the Americans are still trying to get to a lot of things passed to get to the scalable level, because right now the Americans are just trying to buy from a whole bunch of different sources. Now, if we talk about the lowering of quality, that's a factor in this, but where Ukraine is running out of ammunition is not universal. You know, they've got buckets of some stuff and not enough of others. You know, things like precision ammunition or stuff that, you know, stuff for your HIMARS or surface-to-air missiles, those are the you know, those are the stuff that Ukraine is running out of at the moment, and that's largely a financial constraint. This is a, you know, consideration that we, you know, if we give them lots more, they've got to target more things, but it is horrifyingly expensive to give them that. Now, the other consideration, so obviously if they were to, you know, start pulling that back and going to dumber ammunition, yep, much more accessible, much more doable. Then we have the problem of caliber, though. Now, remember, the sort of the most of your Russian kit, effectively, will be the way we'll call it, is 152 mil. Most of your US kit is 155 mil, or NATO kit, effectively. Now, if US were to look at, okay, how can we get Ukraine ready for, you know, very long-term conflict, should we be giving them 152 or 155? Because effectively, if you give them 152, well, let's go 155 first. Give you 155, which is the NATO caliber stuff. It relies on an assumption that they will continue to receive NATO ammunition, and they will continue to receive NATO, you know, parts for better ammunition or better artillery pieces that they will need. So, as an example, you know, most artillery pieces, depending on how good they are, will probably blow through their barrel in, you know, between 1,000 or 3,000 shots, depending on where it's made and what it does. You know, if you give Ukraine all of this, you know, production of 155 mil, and they blow through all the barrels in 6 months, which is not unusual if you're doing high intensity war, then, you know, what guarantee does Ukraine have on receiving 155 millimeter ammunition pieces going forward? Because effectively it will be the US who has to produce them, and Europe will, you know, hasn't got the production of these things in large scale. I mean, frankly, ammunition, artillery, or conventional artillery hasn't been the priority for a lot of these guys. And the only guys who really do make good precision artillery these days are, you know, guys like your South Koreans, who again, probably NATO caliber, probably too expensive for what the Ukrainians need to do with it. The Russians, that's going to be a bit of a problem at the moment. And the Americans. And the Americans are definitely worried that if Trump comes back into power or there is a Republican Congress, and then we've set up all this huge amount of 155 mil ammunition heading to them, and they blow through these barrels, now they're left with effectively a whole bunch of ammo they can't shoot. The other consideration we can go to is 152 mil, which is Russian caliber stuff. Now, that would match with everything that the Ukrainians have left over, had it already existing in their military, already have in their stockpiles, already have racks for, already have with their stuff. And it's also much easier to acquire, A, on the black market, B, from licensed countries. So, for instance, Egypt produces a lot of, 152 caliber stuff. Plus, you can also just make 152 caliber stuff. You know, you could effectively, if you're Europeans, you could go, okay, I'm going to make a whole bunch of 152 caliber shells and I can sell it to Ukraine, is the primary market. But you're also going to have all these markets around the world that use 152. Because again, a lot of countries do tend to use Russian kit because it's cheaper until the war kicked off, easier to acquire, and also usually a bit more robust and simple to use. NATO guys are not very much precision. I guess the best summary of the two artillery doctrines is NATO wants to plop an exact shell on top of your head, whereas Russia has, I remember speaking with a colonel years ago, gave me the phrase, car parks don't fight back, which just means blow it to rubble and we'll talk about it later. And that's why the Russians are much more artillery heavy than the Ukrainians. So this is a conundrum when it comes to ammunition types at the moment, that the US and everyone is a bit hesitant to go, okay, well, if we pump all this, you know, and try and build a massive amount of 155, does that actually sit with what the calibers are going to be needed in, let's say, a year if we move to cheaper, effectively Russian licensed stuff? So the Russians wouldn't get any money for it, but it would be a Russian design, because that would integrate in with what their existing legacy stuff is. I see them probably getting access to NATO stuff further, but, you know, it's a lot more complicated an issue. There's decisions around what caliber it is. It's also where that money should go as well is going to come into it. You know, if you are looking at low intensity war, effectively, that if NATO is making the assumption that we're going to go back to 2014, you wouldn't need mass amounts of artillery shells. You would need, drones. You would need a whole bunch of like odds and ends that would help you solidify the front line. So, you know, if you have a budget or even money put aside for Ukraine, you might want to hold some of that back and use it for things that you might need, or whatever, you know, your considerations or how the battlefield changes. So a lot of different things to cover there, hence why we didn't go down the road. I'll quickly reread the question, make sure I haven't missed anything as well. Also a question like how the West. So the standards and ammunition is kind of, yeah, we went through that, that's fine, but they can lower it. But again, if you, you know, going back to our tank barrel problem, to answer this question about why not lower it, another factor in this is the fact that whether it's a dumb shell, effectively what the North Koreans tend to make, and just pushed out the top of the barrel, or whether it's a shell that's had effectively, you know, additions put onto it, so effectively it detonates at the right altitude, or it can be GPS guided or laser guided, or, you know, effectively a better shell. It doesn't matter to the barrel. It matters slightly, but it's a very minimal question to have. If you only have 1,500 shots in your barrel, why would you want to waste them doing what the Russians do, which is effectively just, you know, just barreling these things out? Moving down to dumb ammunition would solve the ammunition problem, but it's going to induce the expedition of effectively the barrel on the artillery problem. So that's, you know, two factors we got to kind of worry about on this one. Wouldn't obviously mean they were obviously not going to be kept for 20 years in warehouses, nor are they. No, they won't be kept for 20 years in warehouses unless, as we say, we hit the tank barrel problem and we can't get hold of 155 artillery. We've got a whole bunch of 155 shells sitting in there. Nor do we need to be as stupidly accurate. It's fine. They could easily allow for more production to help Ukraine. Again, the production is a bit of the problem, because companies don't know you know, this is what's spooking the market at the moment. If Biden was, let's say, roaring in the polls, and there was or whoever was going to win after Biden was pro-Ukraine, a lot of these companies would probably look at actually setting up, you know, wider scale production. As a classic example, a couple of small firms have like pivoted and set up a small little workshop to make 152 mil stuff to keep the Ukrainian artillery going. But they haven't invested very long term. They haven't built massive infrastructure and brought on all this new staff and kind of like expanded the business, expecting an expedition upwards. They've only got temporary facilities for these things because there's a worry in you know, the defense community that if Trump gets back in, then we may see a cancellation of, you know, funds towards Ukraine, to which all of these guys and companies who then spent, you know, $1 million to set up their you know, artillery, you know, shell making facility may go bankrupt at that point, because there will be no demand for them apart from, you know, small demands to refill stockpiles. You know, this is the trouble that, yeah, having one president or having one candidate, sorry, effectively pulling the other way is having on the market. So a lot of companies are, you know, they were getting their artillery production up. They're doing a bit well. Everyone's getting there. And then they've seen Trump kind of become the nominee, or get, you know, be the presumptive nominee, and go, okay, let's not expand. Let's see how the election goes. So now we're in a horrible state where we wait to see what happens in November. Yeah, not that I have any political leanings. So yeah, in last bit, there'd be a less appealing 20 market. That's so yeah, the shells corruption wise, the actually are more appealing if the dumber they are. With, you know, with the really, really good US stuff, there are ways of, you know, making it difficult to fire them. So, you know, your average insurgent will not be able to fire them. And again, artillery shells at this caliber, we're talking massive 155, 152 mil shells, are not prime, you know, prime workshop stuff for insurgencies. You know, what you want from your insurgents are, you know, Dushkas, PKMs, RPDs, RPGs, high technicals, small arms, small arm caliber munitions, hand grenades, you know, particular man pads if you can get your hands on it. Effectively stuff that is not only portable, not only easy to hide, not only, but also really easy to train someone on, and doesn't require a lot of pre-weaponry. You know, artillery shells are great for an army who's using conventional forces, but, you know, you're not going to be, if you are ISIS or whatever, you're not going to be hit and running with a 155 mil artillery piece. I mean, it could be very impressive. You're probably going to be looking more down the barrel of, you know, small little mortars. So, yeah, the worry is that it may be sold to other nation states. That's, you know, if a nation is looking at, you know, they have to replenish their ammunition because some of it just is old shitty stuff, some of the wiring's bad, you know, they could sell it off. Some of it be sold to the Russians, because the Russians could, even if it's 152 particularly, they could fire it. Yeah, so there's a whole bunch of different factors in this, and I've been pretty rambly here too, but generally it comes down to the barrel, you know, that's going to be problems. What caliber ammunition is going to be problems. No problem with selling off weapons now, but what happens at the end of the war, which is exactly, that's the situation we saw in Kosovo and Libya and Yugoslavia and, you know, the end of the Cold War, that whilst those weapons are needed on the battlefield, draws in weapons. The moment it ends, everyone starts selling. That's the concern. Again, I don't, you know, most of the Ukrainians I met over my travels and talks have been very, very reasonable. I don't see the open nation corruption that I tend to find when with the Russians, but it's a concern that is raised by people. And I think, you know, it would be, as much as I know I sit on, you know, the Ukrainian side in this particular issue, it would be, you know, unread line like to not give both sides, I guess. So hopefully that answers your question. And let me know if there's any other follow-ups or any other questions you have come through, because I think it's always good to be able to answer it. Well, thanks again.